Have you made an honest review? Jump onto fifthwrist.com and read real takes by real owners about their watches. And of course, get involved and write about what's on your wrist. Fifthwrist.com is your independent space to talk watches.
Welcome to the Independent Thinking Show for Fifth Wrist Radio. This is a place dedicated to showcasing the great people doing interesting things in the world of horology. My name is Roman, and today I'm joined by my frequent co-host and friend, Adam from Medium Watch. Hey, Adam, how's it going?
All good. How are you?
Yeah, look, it's okay. It's fine. Given everything else that's happened in the world, this is a happy place.
Good. Yeah, sure. Always good to see. Asking that question. Oh, goodness.
Yeah, exactly. Well, look, the reason for us getting together, as always, is we have a very, very cool guest today. Now, so I'll try it. Once again, it's very hard to introduce some of our guests, and this is no exception. So our guest today is a legendary personality on the watch scene. Let's go with that. He fulfills the role of the resident collector on probably my favorite online watch publication, Quill and Pad, where he regularly contributes columns about aspects of the industry and also dispenses sage advice to collectors worldwide. He's also a keen and skillful watch photographer who regularly gets to showcase some of the most desirable watches to us mere mortals. A member of the GPHG jury and an all-round scholar and gentleman, please welcome Mr. Gary G to Fifth Wrist Radio. Hello, Gary. Great to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, this is almost a dream guest. I think when Adam and I started this collaboration, we drew up a little short list and we're slowly, you know, ticking them off. But your name was very high on the list. You know, we've had Roger Smith. We've managed to, well.
Me, Roger Smith, God.
We've got two out of the. Exactly.
Patiently waiting here.
Exactly. We've got two of our top three. I think we've got the Pope left. That's about it. I think we can retire after this, Adam, finally.
Oh, we've got to get George Daniels.
We might have to call a medium for that, but that's all right. We'll work on this. No, but look, Gary, it's a real pleasure to have you on the show. I said you're a dream guest. Because personally, you know, I've been a big fan of your writing and I've been a really big fan of your sort of honest insights that you've been sharing with the collecting community for a while now. And it certainly helped to shape some of my thinking about watches and watch collecting. So I really want to thank you for that.
Well, thank you. You're very, very welcome. It's, you know, I have to tip a hat to Elizabeth and Ian at Quill and Pad, who pretty much let me write about whatever I want to. I think there was one article idea. I don't even remember what it was, but I submit a list to Elizabeth once, you know, every few months, and say, well, here's a list of 20, and I'd like to do X. And one time she said, well, maybe we should hold that one for later, and it's on indefinite hold. But I don't even remember what it was. But they basically, you know, they give me free rein, and I try not to offend too much within that, but. But it's a fun variety for me. You know, I get to do photography-based articles. I write about watches I buy. I've written about watches I've sold. I review some watches from manufacturers. And I shoot a lot of friends' watches, which is a real treat. And then I get to write opinion pieces on aspects of the watch business, which kind of relates back to my day job. And so it's good fun for me. And when it stops being fun, I'll stop doing it. But so far, you know, 8 years in, we're still cranking.
Wonderful. Wonderful. I'm hoping you're not planning to stop anytime soon. You know, I think you're just reaching the early stages of your most productive years. Let's go with that.
Okay.
Oh, all right. Well, look, the way we usually kick off these shows is, you know, we do a wrist check and a drink check. Maybe we'll throw in a location check as well, because it's always good to, you know, to sort of explain to people how transatlantic these conversations tend to be. So maybe I'll throw to Adam first to do the honors.
So on my wrist is a Patek Philippe 5050G silver dial. The reason why I picked it up, I wanted to get a Grail watch for, you know, after loving things like the Oxygen Calendar Light that I can wear any. For me, this was it. My drink, given that it is in the afternoon now and it's the day after the day Coke Zero, and I am the greater Boston area.
Wonderful.
So, Gary.
I was just going to say it's wonderful. I always want to know what you pour into the Coke Zero can when you tip out the actual content, but that's fine. We won't need to, that's too early in the podcast. Dylan. Congratulations on that watch. I know, yeah, like you and I have been chatting about it, and I know how significant the watch is in, you know, being a milestone for some personal achievements and also watch collecting achievements. So that's, you know, huge congratulations from the other side of the beautiful. Gary, we'll go to you as our esteemed guest.
Okay, well, first of all, 5050G, very sweet. That's a lovely piece. And, you know, in my very early days, I really lusted after the 5059, but the dial was too florid for 5050 with minimalist indices is just right. You may or may not recall, a good friend of mine has the 5059G Salmon with the 5050 mm-hmm. style dial. Mm. And that's also a piece of that whole family. And that dial style in particular, I think, is wonderful. So good for you. I am, let's see, what am I wearing? I'm actually double wristing today. In your honor, you know, I mean, I figured I'd use them both. So I've got the Reshepi.
Oh, wow. Chronometz.
Chronometer Contemporain 01.
Goodness me.
Red gold black enamel dial in honor of independence, among other things, because it's a relatively recent acquisition, and I just love wearing the darn thing. It's just, you know, it's a delight. And on my other wrist I have something at the other end of the spectrum. It's the Timex Marlin recreation of a few years ago, and the reason I'm wearing that is that the first watch I ever owned that my dad gave to me was a Timex Marlin, which sadly has been a loss to history. But when Timex came out with the re-edition, which is actually quite faithful, my wife was kind enough to buy it for me. And it was a $195 watch. And I actually wear it a fair amount. Great on the wrist, very clean. And, as I'm fond of saying, they're great watches at all price points. So I thought I'd kind of start with the opposite extremes. What I'm drinking, if you'd like, you know, given that it's kind of, you know, the time we'd otherwise be at Basel, you could picture me with a Negroni standing at the Three Kings Bar. Nice. But in reality, since we're ramping up for Watches and Wonders, where I'll have maybe 20 espressos a day, I'm having them keep the caffeine level, you know, on a steady ramp up for the next couple of weeks. And I'm sitting in lovely Northern California, the kind of the northern edge of Silicon Valley, for those who know it, about halfway between San Francisco and San Jose. And if you walk to the front of the house here and you look to east, you see the Stanford campus.
Lovely.
And I'm looking over the top of my computer screen because after a gray morning, it has turned absolutely gorgeous out there. Really nice blue skies. Anyway.
Lovely.
So, Roman.
Oh, it's always a tough gig to go after Gary. Always tough. But that's fine. Also, I just wanted to say before I talk about my watch, well played, Adam, for getting a 5050G when we have Gary G on the podcast. That's beautiful.
A lot of G's here.
You know, alignment. It's all the synergies of this recording is just, it's beautiful. Yeah, it's just to give you. So I'll do my drink. I'll get the disappointing news out of the way. So it's 7:50 a.m. in Melbourne in the middle of the week. So I'm drinking water, unfortunately, because I've got a meeting actually right after this, a work meeting where intoxication will not be a desired side effect. So a disappointingly just a glass of water for me. On the wrist, I have my newest watch. It is a Sartori Billard that I just bought. Ooh. It's an SB4. So I've been actually wearing this watch quite a lot. So this is a Fume dial, which is the first one that Armand has done for SB4. So this was, an historic watch, and I use inverted commas for that. But it's very, very nice. I'm very happy with it. The other thing that Armand has done for me is he's designed the font to be a recreation of a old Cyrillic font, which is kind of, you know, I hail from Ukraine originally. So this is kind of recreating an old Ukrainian script, I ordered this watch, you know, in 2021 before the current craziness was underway, but I got this watch just before the current conflict had started. And obviously thoughts, and really back to the old country. So I've been wearing this watch quite a lot, and every time I look at it, it does remind me of, yeah, lots of mixed emotions. I'm happy to have the watch, but also the fleeting kind of, you know, essence of time that we all have, and, you know, the darker thoughts that go with it. So it's a really meaningful watch, very special watch for me. So yeah, so wearing that on the wrist. Sorry, I didn't mean to bring the mood down. I'll put some jokes in. Don't worry. We'll lighten the mood in a minute. No, look, it's a great watch. And Armand has done a fantastic job. So anyone who's not familiar with Satoru Biard, definitely check him. He's a great guy to work with. Amazing skill. And location-wise, you know, I'm in overcast, grey Melbourne, Australia. Yeah, which is my home for, has been my home for 20 years. So, yeah. Very, very cool. All right, that's good. I think we did well with the drink checks. Were a bit, you know, light on, you know, but the wrist checks we definitely killed. I think there is solid. I think that's probably our strongest wrist check for a long time. And the other thing, I love Gary, the double wristing Gary G wrist check really reminded me of kind of why I loved your writing and why I really enjoy your writing, because you apply the same no snob factor to all ends of the horological spectrum. And you really tie the watches and stories really well. I mean, you mentioned your wife got you that watch on Quill and Pad. There's been some really lovely stories about, you know, JLC reversos that you and your wife had. And, you know, you've really managed to kind of convey how watches fit into your life and milestones along the way really nicely. So really beautiful.
I guess the Marlin helps us dive into the first question. So you received this Marlin from your father, and it could have just been your only watch, but somehow you went from having a Marlin being a watch collector, which is someone who has multiple watches.
Obviously. What happened?
Yeah.
What in the world happened? Well, you know, the Marlin was my first watch. You know, you guys, I'm sure, asked a lot of people, a lot of men in particular, about their origin stories with watches. And in my experience with men especially, it's almost always either my dad had a watch or my grandfather had a watch, right? In my case, my grandfather had a watch that I still have, in fact. And it's a pocket watch, not a valuable piece. I just remember I loved that watch. I loved that watch, and I'm so happy to still have that. And then my dad got me a watch, and I thought that was great. And I, you know, I don't remember a time when I just didn't love watches. So it wasn't a thing where suddenly, you know, I was 25 or 30 years old, and I, you know, I got a big promotion or something, and I thought, well, maybe I'll buy a watch. When I was in high school, I played instruments, musical instruments. And I'll be clear, there's a difference between being an instrumentalist and a musician. I was an instrumentalist, right? Someone who could move his fingers and blow. But I somehow got in this band that toured Europe. High school, you know, all-star band. Because I played a really obscure instrument. That's the key. And the alto clarinet, which you probably never heard of.
Wow.
And,
you really
anyways, so I,
wow.
Yeah. So there weren't very many. I got picked. This is, you know, sometimes you have to do these things. So I had to raise the money to go because we didn't have any money. So I went around and, you know, worked some jobs and went and talked at the Parent Teacher Association, and they gave me $50 and, you know, and so I got the money together and we went, and I had, I think, $48 in spending money.
Wow.
And one of the places that we went was Lucerne. And Bucher has that store right at the tip of the lake, right? And they took us in there.
Wow.
And I spent 42 of my $48 on a watch, which now I've had, what, for 51 years. And I still have the watch. I still wear it from time. It still runs great. And it's a blue dial steel case, kind of a tonneau case. Well, a really unusual kind of watch. But I just really, you know, it was a beautiful thing, and I had to have it. You know, time passes. I go to work. I decide I have to buy myself like a nice dress watch. So I bought myself this little tiny Cartier tank watch that my, and I immediately had buyer's remorse, got a lot of money. And I calculated that if I wore it every day for the rest of my life, it would cost 10 cents a day. I thought, well, I guess I can afford 10 cents a day if it's the only watch I ever buy. But that clearly didn't take. So then, I don't know, it sat, kind of sat for a while. And I'd go and, travel on business and go by the duty free shops and peer in the windows, and there are all sorts of pretty watches. But then my wife and I were in Paris, and there used to be a jeweler on the Rue de la Paix, where now it's the IWC boutique. And it was run by a family, and they had JLC. And this was, 1992-ish. And I kind of heard of him, but he brought out this watch, rectangular watch, and a beautiful reverso. And he showed it to me, and then he said, "But wait." And he flipped it over, and there was a second time zone. It was the original reverso duo with the silver on the front and the black on the back. And that honey ostrich strap. It's like, I gotta have it. I've gotta have it. And so, dug deep and bought that watch. And then my late first wife said, "Gee, well, I should get a watch too." So she also got actually a more expensive ladies gold reverso on the bracelet. But that was really the start of the thing, the real collecting thing. And I went from there to the Geographique, the original one with the rounded case that I still own in yellow gold. Super, super. It keeps unbelievable time. When I had it serviced a number of years ago, they sent the timing slip with, and there wasn't a number on it that was 0+1, 0-1, 0. I mean, it was unbelievable. Wow. And I keep it on the winder. It keeps perfect time. But then I started making some more money, working hard, bust your ass for years. Maybe I should reward myself with such and such. And there's a guy named Tim Jackson. Do you know Tim?
Yeah, a friend of the show. He's been a previous guest on the podcast.
Yeah, well, he used to have his shop up here in our area. Now he's down in Southern California. But he, as you know, is a big, big promoter of the independents. And so I moved out here in the late 90s, kind of was investigating the watch scene and stumbled across Tim. And that was a whole revelation right there, and he'd have Peter Speak Marincom and Kari and Vianney, and the McGonigal brothers and Marco Lam.
To have.
Yeah. But talk about eye opening. And then, so then the independents came into my life, and he and in the store, there was a watch that I really, really admired. Which was the Audemars Piguet. And you think of that watch, it's one of the greatest watches ever in my home. It's perpetual calendar, moon phase, equation of time, time of sunrise and sunset in a given location. All done, for people who don't really know watches, all done with like springs and levers and shit, right? Yeah. I mean, it's not, no electronic circuits or anything. And it's got, the 2120 ultra thin self-winding base move, one of the greatest movements of all time, with the skeleton rotor. I mean, I just, I just thought I gotta have one of these. And I was on Purus, and there's a guy named Alan, to this day, a really good friend of mine. I'd never met him, and he had one. And I wrote to him and I said, "Gee, if you ever think of selling that watch?" And he still has his. But I kind of, on this search. And I was down at Tim's one day, and I said, "Geez, the piece that I would really love to have, AP equation." His eyes kind of lit up. He said, "We happen to have one in the safe in the back."
No way.
Was it from San Francisco or somewhere else?
A San Francisco watch.
Wow.
A San Francisco watch. They had it in the safe in the back. And it had been brought in by a couple who are both big collectors to this day. And the husband had been wearing the watch, and he'd fouled it up.
Right.
And so it was all, the moon didn't move, and I got a tremendous deal. I mean, I can't believe how little I paid for this. But the condition was that, I had to buy it, and then we were going to send it to get it fixed back to
AP. Sure.
Because there was another friend, a guy I didn't know at the time, today also a really great friend of mine who also was interested in the watch. But said, "No, why don't you get it fixed first, and then I'll decide." So I bought it right out from under him. He's nice. Still mad.
Cutthroat world.
Well, either you want it or you don't. Yeah. But you know, and then so, you know, at Tim's joint, you know, he had kind of those sorts of watches, but also all the indies. And then I met up with these crazy guys, the Nornia Gang, that formed around Tim's, really. And then we all bought observatoires from Kari Voutilainen and then took delivery around the same time. Mm-hmm. Then we commissioned our chronographs from Kari, the six unique pieces out of the series of 10 chronograph twos, is a story, that whole thing. And, you know, and then it just becomes a matter of, you know, you buy some stuff and then, it, you know, a year later you say, geez, what was I thinking? You know, it's finding your taste, refining your taste, arguing with your friends. The forums were a big deal in those days. So, you know, getting on the Purists and Time Zone and saying, hey, what do you think about X? And they say, well, I love it. I hate it. And here's why. And you discuss it. And but just getting involved in the community of people. There are watches involved, but it's all about the people. And, you know, once you meet the collectors and the enthusiasts and the makers, and even, you know, the great majority of the industry figures, it hooks you. And then the watches become more interesting. You were mentioning, right at the outset, I think Adam, maybe it was you, about, you know, there's a story, right? There's a story. When I talk about a watch, there's always, well, yeah, there's a story about behind every watch. And, you know, and the story generally involves people and people you're close to or people you've gotten to know and really admire. Whoever it is, you know, and just being able to have that experience of knowing the people and sharing, you know, sharing that bit of their lives is, to me, what's so gratifying. That's a long answer to a short question, though.
No, it was great. Absolutely. It was perfect. I just wanted to ask, how fast was the slide from, oh, this GLC looks great, to commissioning a Kari chronograph? And I'm asking for a friend, let's just say.
Well, yeah. So the JLC, the big kind of initial JLC, you know, phase, which phase included, I bought, what were the other ones? I don't know, a couple other reversos. A reverso minute repeater I actually bought from my friend Alan, the first time I ever met him. Wow. I met him at the Neiman Marcus coffee shop in Union Square, and he brought the watch. And I said, "Okay, I'll write you a check right now." And he was sort of taken aback. So that was kind of, you know, from, I say, 1992 to 2002.
Wow, that's a productive decade.
And then you know, picking up with Tim and all that was probably, you know, 2003 or so. We all got our observatoires, I think, in 2008. And then after a long wait, it seemed, the chronographs, the Kari chronographs, finally 2011. So 20 years, you know, I mean, it wasn't a week. And there were a lot of, you know, like the blue dialed, you know, Luce Nardin 44 millimeter monstrosity that, you know, it just looks so great in the case, but then it's like the week after you have it, it's like, man, that's really good.
Yes.
You know, and some other really nice pieces. I had a UN, the mono pusher, you know, with the PHA movement.
Yeah, it's beautiful piece.
Beautiful piece. But, you know, unless you have infinite assets, which I don't, you know, you can't keep everything. And you wear something for a while and you say, geez, you know, there's something else I'd like. And you know, would I sell something to have it? And if so, what? And that I guess that to me is part of the joy of it. But it's also kind of a pain sometimes. Say, geez, you know, sometimes I think about that watch and I think, boy, I wish I had that watch. Yeah, I mean, there's, wish I kind of kept that. If we all woke up rich tomorrow, whatever we wanted. Maybe. Let me tell you a story about that. I won't mention the guy's name, but you know who this is. He's a famous, famous guy who recently bought a very expensive watch at auction. He's a big collector and owns a lot of really, really important. And I asked him a couple of years ago, I said, doesn't it bother you sometimes that, you know, you don't have to make trade-offs and you don't have to sell to buy and the kind of the the thrill of the chase really isn't there for you, and that, you know, you're not having to make any sacrifices. And he sat there and he looked at me. He said, could you ask me again? I don't understand the question. And so I asked it a different way, and I asked it a third way. And then finally he looked at me and goes, no, I like it. I like having anything I want. Like, okay, fine. So yeah. So my whole preaching about how rewarding it is to have to make sacrifices, you know, it's all, I'm lying to myself. You know, I've never had the other experience.
Well, I think most of us have never had that other experience. And look, I'm a bit like you, the pain is part of the joy, you know, the pain of even regret or just the necessity to prune down and, you know, edit your own collection in a sense. I find that certainly has sharpened my collecting skills, because otherwise the tendency is always just to accumulate and acquire and, you know, acquire pieces without really thinking about them. It's just, you know, it's sort of an instant grab, particularly now in social media or watches being really available always, 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 you know, click away. So I actually, yeah, I'm sort of more like that. Yeah.
Always, and oh, if you don't hit the button in the next 17 seconds, you're not going to get one. Like, well,
that's a whole other discussion.
Then you hit the button, it's like, well, did I really want that? Or was it because I, you know, I could? So I've had one.
Proto drives me to vintage. So you're collecting the process. Has that process evolved? Do you think these thought processes are in, or do you need to periodically?
You know, there's a really, you know, it's always, there's always a story, right? A good friend, another good friend of mine, and he has this portfolio taxonomy for watch collecting that I find really, look, you need some watches that are basically foundational watch. And, you know, he came up with this a long time before, you know, who knew watches would have value? You know, this was not the point. It's not investment watches. This was foundational watches, you know, that, you know, you want to have a datagraph or, you know, Upatek perpetual calendar or, you know, whatever it is, right? A Vianney Halter Antiqua, that there are certain pieces that are, you know, or I hope, you know, a Recep Recepi CC that are just, you know, they're bedrock pieces of any collection.
Yes.
And that as a collector, you don't want to be a slave to convention, because then, you know, everyone has a datagraph, you have a datagraph. Everyone has a 5970, you have a 5970. You know, I mean, if everyone had the same collection, if everyone had all foundational pieces, it would be a boring world.
Yes.
So group two is patronage, right? Buying from the independents and select brands, but really supporting watchmaking as a living art. You know, I own, you know, some vintage pieces, but mostly I buy the works of living makers. And I think that's important. So, you know, he and our whole kind of Northern California watch gang, we're big, independent enthusiasts. And so there's a certain set of watches that, you know, who knew that independent watches would ever be worth anything, but, you know, where it's like, okay, you know, our friend Alan is great about it. He bought, you know, Ludovic Bouwaard's first upside down.
Oh,
you know, imagine. And you know, and you know, I mean, and to this day, he's buying these emerging watchmakers pieces, and he's got a tremendous eye for them. But it's primarily that you're supporting these people who could have stayed at AP or JLC or Patek or whatever and done perfectly well, but there was something about who they were that made them need to go out and suffer in the way that they do, to express themselves. And you know, again, my philosophy is that some portion of your collection should be, you know, for patronage. It's really to support watchmaking. And then third is fun, right? You know, watches that, and often fun watches are less expensive, but sometimes, you know, you kind of cheat and you buy something that's like really fun and you spend, you know, a decent amount of money on it and you're not so sure about that. But so you just got to indulge yourself something and say, you know what, I may keep this watch forever. I may keep this watch for a year. I don't care really that much if it holds value or not, but it's just, you know, you gotta live it up sometimes and just once in a while, you know, I don't have a spreadsheet or anything, but I'll go down to the bank and open up the safe box and, you know, make the list and come home and look at the few pieces I keep in the safe. And, okay, well, am I out of balance? Because it happened, you know, where independent, and all said, geez, you know, what, you know, or I where'd all the vintage pieces go? Or where'd the, you know, oh my God, I sold my Datagraph Perpetual, you know, and now there's a hole there. You know, so I think having some sense of balancing these sort of foundational pieces, patronage pieces and fun pieces helped me a lot. And then I'm at the point very much where, you know, I have to sell to buy. If I'm going to buy anything that's really a significant piece, it requires that like less well. And that's, I think it's a good discipline to have. And you know, coming up and collecting, there was always the, you know, sell three, buy one, sell three, buy one, sell three, buy one. You know, you do that for a while, and then you got three watches and you can't ever wear any of them because they're too expensive for you. Then it's like, yes, I got to go buy myself $1,000 watch so I have something to wear and I get a beater.
Yes.
So there's that too, you know, where you go through these periods of consolidation and going up, and then you say, well, geez, maybe I actually need to fill in the foundation a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I've written about this, the idea of not getting hurt. Used to be when collectors talked, a lot of it was, you know, oh, I just bought whatever, you know, 50-50G. So I say, well, you're not going to get hurt on that. You know, because that was a real, very real possibility, right? That you'd buy something and tomorrow it'd be worth 30 cents on the dollar or whatever it is. And sure, you're going to spend more than you have. You want to be pretty comfortable that by and large, you know, yeah, you might not get out what you spent on it, or you might, well, who knows? But I think the idea of saying, you know, you want to limit your downside a little bit, especially if, you know, some of us, you know, you have more money in watches than you really should. From a balance perspective. And then I think, you know, lastly, find your taste. And, you know, people say buy what you love. Some people don't like that expression because it's like, well, I fell in love and I something or another. But I think it's more about really having the discussions with people you respect, trying enough pieces, and, you know, and then over time, just buying and selling in a way that the selection that you have really speaks to you personally. I think that's really the thing. And who cares what anyone else thinks? Mm-hmm. We were having dinner with Mr. Dufour a few years ago. Every time we, by long tradition, we have dinner with him at IHH. We're trying to set it up for a while. Difficult. But every you know, you sit with Mr. Dufour and he says, it's like there's wisdom. You know, it's like, yes, you wish you could just tape record everything the man says, right? And he just says these things, matter of fact, about, you know, how do you design and install a watch dial so it never corrodes, you know, and or how do you hold the piece and the file and move them like a violin and a string so that the bow finds the string, you know, and what temperature is, you know, the bow in your hand when you're polishing the sink before, you know, before it's perfectly polished. Yeah, write it down. So he hadn't unleashed any of these yet, and it was getting near the end of the dinner. And I said, look, every year we I'm kind of a pain in the ass. Yeah. You know, Mr. Dufour, every year you say, you give us some wisdom, and you haven't had any yet. Give us some wisdom. And there are a lot of watches out. Take your time.
That's beautiful. It's beautiful.
That's like wisdom on demand. Okay.
Yeah. Wow.
I mean, you can feel the hairs of the back of my neck stand up.
Yeah. 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 Wow. Yeah.
There's a lot of watches. They take your time. So that's probably the best, kind of the best short answer philosophy of collecting.
I think we've got the episode title right there. I mean, we can spend the rest of our time just talking about that one sentence. Wow.
Yeah. None of us have a shortage.
That is deep. Why does we need to bring out, you know, a bit like Sun Tzu, The Art of War. We need to have, like, you know, a collection of aphorisms from Philippe Dufour. Surely there's a book in there somewhere.
Oh, you know, he's I've written some of them down. You know, his famous line that I love it. The cemeteries are full of watchmaking secrets.
Yes.
You know, and it's a living art, and that he had to recreate from his study of restoration. A bunch of techniques. He said, watch companies don't need George Clooney. The manufacturers are full of George Clooney. watchmakers are fascinating. It's like, well, not all watchmakers, but he's fast, you know. But so he's got a thousand of these things, yeah. And I really should, because he's a guy with real and a tremendous sense of humor. He's a very funny. I don't know if you know him well at all. You know, he's always cracking some joke.
So you're really praising Philippe Dufour, and you're essentially his customer, right? I mean, ultimately, he's selling you something, and you are a bit over 20 years ago, you wrote a book that was called Customer, which provides a framework for measuring customers and suggested that organizations think of customers as assets. I mean, what better than to treasure your interactions with? So how should watch brands apply these the same across all market segments?
Wow. Well, I have to say I'm deeply flattered that you have dug up customer equity. It's a rare pleasure for me to be able to speak on the topic, especially to a watch related audience. But I remember maybe the only other time I was named a distinguished alumnus of my high school a few years ago, and I went to this ceremony, and a fellow came up to me and he said, "I read your book." Man, that is like the greatest thing that ever happened to me. Because in my career of 40 years, I'm virtually unknown. In the world of watches, you know, Gary G, I'm not well known, but Gary G is. I play him online. So thanks for asking. Customer equity. Yeah, the basic idea, as you said, is that customer relationships are valuable assets. Their financial value can a lot of people have heard of the idea of customer lifetime value. It's useful, but it's kind of a blunt tool because, as it turns out, customer relationships have a number of stages, have life cycles, right? And so if you're a company or a watchmaker and you're dealing with customers, you acquire customers, you retain them, and then you basically cross-sell them. And if you're lucky, like I just did, you get recommended to others, right? So there's acquisition equity, retention equity, expansion equity, and referral equity as a way of thinking about it. And each of those is a separate thing and can be measured separately and managed separately. And so depending on, as you just said, right, the segment you're dealing with or the brand you are, you should prioritize one of those more than the others. And you manage them differently. So, so much for the theoretical blah, blah. Specific examples. A Rolex. My guess, Rolex sells a million watches a year. I'm guessing that they sell those, that 990,000 of those people are buying their very first night and that they will never, ever buy another. I'm guessing. I could be wrong. But, Rolex, it, to me, is a classic example of a company that should be running an customer acquisition strategy, which they do, right? They got, I'm old enough, right? Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus, Gary Player, Martina Navratilova, Yvonne Lendl, Roger Federer, these ambassadors who stand for something, stand for the brand. They're widely distributed. Used to be you could actually buy them if you wanted them. There are entry priced watches for you. I think in terms of doing anything, as a manufacturer, certainly their dealers probably do more kind of customer retention stuff. But if I'm Rolex, I'm out there doing exactly what they're doing and acquiring as many of the, of the X million new people who turn 27 years old each year to buy a Rolex as I can. Patek Philippe, they're kind of running the classic Alfred Sloan General Motors ladder strategy, right? You buy a Chevy, then you buy a Pontiac, then you buy an Oldsmobile. Sorry for the American references. Then maybe you buy a Buick, and then you buy a Cadillac, as you go up the scale. And so you have an offering at every price point, a watch for every taste.
The Nautilus being the economical option, of course.
I'm sorry?
The Nautilus being the economical option, of course.
Being the cheap one, yeah. The entry watch. The entry watch. So that's much more of a classic, you know, retention model, right? You acquire, retain, you upsell people over time. You have people who are loyal to the brand. For all I know, you know, 99% of their customers only buy one watch too, but I'm making a point. I'll go somewhere else. MBNF, right? Max Bucer and his gang. That's a retention model. People who are buying MBNFs are buying multiple MBNFs, right? And they're managing the relay. They've got the tribe. They do a lot of existing customer management. It's a high touch model directly from the manufacturer. It's one of the few examples I can think of where they're actually running relationship expansion, right? They get the Mad Gallery. They are cross-selling you into different categories. I have on my desk the Loop System rocket ship collaboration. They're more than most watch companies, they're running that play. But one of the tenets of customer equity is when you're really good at one of those strategies, then maybe you should think about applying the others. Like, you know, if you have a really strong left arm, maybe you should do some with your right arm. So you see Max is out there with the Mad Watch, right? The Mad One. He's running an acquisition play on a whole different market segment, you know, which is really, really clever from a customer equity perspective, because he's got this retention and line extension strategy going with his core customers. And now he's going to pick up another segment of people and potentially run the same play. Reshepi. Okay. If you already own the RRCC1, he won't let you buy an RRCC2. Period. And so what he's doing is he's running an customer acquisition strategy, right? He's broadening the base of people who can own his watches, right? So it's not Kari Voutilainen, on the other hand, if you were an early customer of his, you can pretty much get whatever you want.
Right.
You know, if you hear ahead of time, or, you know, he tells you, or, you know, you go to the first day of the show and you see, you know, the inverse. It's like, you know, 12 of my buddies said, I want the inverse. They all got one, you know, right. Because they were early customers of his, and they were going to get first dibs. That's a fundamentally different customer equity model than someone who's saying, no, look, I'm really going to hold aside. I mean, this gets back to the Nautilus thing, right? What Patek isn't doing is holding aside a certain percentage of Nautiluses or the preponderance of Nautiluses to say, we want to attract new customers to the brand with this. They're not specifically not doing that, and their dealers aren't. And that, you know, in some ways you could view that, you know, I'm not here to give business advice, but it's kind of a mistake from a customer equity, because it paints you into a corner. So, I mean, and Moser, another great example, right? New brand, what do you focus on? Acquisition, customer acquisition. So they do all this wacky advertising. They're highly visible. They're fairly accessible watches. Edward Mylan is, you know, doing the Swiss made thing with the cow. And but at some point, you know, you have to make a transition to establishing a lasting brand and retaining and you know, further selling to your retained customer base. And that's a difference. And I think they're actually doing a good job, you know, with their products. And also, he's so visible on social media. And, you know, if you write something about one of his watches on Instagram, you're going to get a response from him on Instagram. I know that he's doing that personally. I bet he's doing a fair amount of it. But managing those transitions is also a tricky thing. So even in the watch business, yeah, we see that there are different strategies you can pursue, and that different companies are and should be doing it differently. Can I go on for just another minute on that?
Yeah, please.
There are ways to do this wrong. Saying, you know, we're going to focus on customer retention and expansion. Therefore, to get certain pieces, you have to be a long-standing customer of the house. Yeah. That I kind of get. That's okay. Ferrari kind of pioneered a lot of that, and a lot of the watch brands have kind of done it. Doing it wrong is saying, well, you know, I've got a hot item and I'm making all these other watches I can't really sell, and so I'm going to bundle them. And if you walk in off the street, I'll sell you the tough to get one if you buy one of these dogs. Okay. Even though I've never met you before and you're not really an existing customer. That's not customer relationship management. That's moving inventory. That's a different thing. And we see both happening.
Are there any reasons Reshepi and Voutilainen have different strategies?
You know, Kari is one of the most fascinating business, period. And certainly in the watch industry. I think, you know, with Reshep, you know, his view is he's just getting started. He doesn't want to limit himself. He doesn't know how high or far he's going to go. And for him, it's about avoiding a constraint.
Sure.
Right. And you know, he had his, you know, he did have his struggles, right? The early years of Acrivia, 5, 6, 7 years where people weren't lining up to buy the thing. So he, you know, it's not that he thinks it all will come easy always. It's not that. I think he really is managing an upside. Kari, on the other hand, I think he's a loyal guy. He's loyal to the people who supported him when he, you know, was really first starting out. And also, he is a revenue maximizer, okay? And you think about, first of all, you know, things he's done in his supply chain, some of which is, you know, just being able to get parts. Combermin for the dials and Voutilainen and Catan for the cases and, you know, all that. But also, you know, they're diversifications of his industrial base. And then, you know, he did that thing with Schwartz Etienne, which I think he considers to be probably not a big success, but an experiment. You know, I mean, he's willing to run these market experiments.
Yes,
right?
Sure.
He did those horrifying cell phone cases.
Oh, I remember that. That was horrific. Sorry. If you're listening, not your best. But yeah, we're big fans here, but you know.
Well, no, I wrote about it and you know, and I got in a lot of, you know, hot water with people for, you know, because, well, you should be supporting the independent. No, it just rang false to me.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
But again, you know, almost no one remembers it now. And maybe, you know, if you just heard this, forget about it, please. you know, he's out there. You know, and now with Urban Jurgensen,
yes,
it's like, you know, who knows where he's going to go? But he's, you know, he's. I think he can envision finding other ways to broaden his base beyond saying, you know, I'm going to withhold watches from people who have been loyal to me in order to sell the next set of watches to a different set of people. Reshep's at a very different point in his career and in the maturity of his business. So I think that helps to explain part of it, you know. But also, I think Reshep is maybe in a way that Kari, you know, isn't. Reshep's looking to his legacy, right? He's a very, you know, serious young man, and thinking about what his place could be and how to manage that. And he's getting some really good counsel, you know, from Mike Tay and from Silas Walton about, you know, how to manage, you know, a consumer products and luxury goods business. And whereas Kari, I think, you know, he's just got good instincts and he's an expansionist.
Interesting. So you've mentioned some ups and downs over the years. A particular down that's memorable is that relative to unit volumes in 2019 and 2021, there were decreases in sales at every price point except over 3,000 Swiss. What strategic advice would you give to watchmakers in these segments, both below and above?
Well, I would hate to be making 3,000 franc or 2,500 franc Swiss watch, especially an independent watch. I'd hate to be, because anything I can do, if I can buy a movement and case it up and make a pretty nice looking dial and put my name on the front, try to sell it to you, 2,500, even 5,000, you know, I mean, it's kind of no man's land. There's somebody out there who can make a dial that at least in pictures looks just as good, slap a cheap movement behind it, and sell it direct to consumer online for $300. And, you know, the whole emergence of design forward micro brands has really, to me, just changed the landscape. And of course, you know, smartwatches and people, you know, do I want to wear a less expensive wristwatch? I think people do actually want to wear less expensive wristwatches. but they don't want to wear a 2,500 franc Swiss watch that looks a lot like a $300 Kickstarter watch. And you know, shows how memories are. 2019, I was the moderator for a panel at Dubai Watch Week on whether smartwatches were going to kill the watch industry. And the general view was, could be, you know.
Yes.
I remember
yes.
Jack Forster made a long excursion from the audience about, you know, yeah, well, you know, you guys are all full of it. I think the watch industry is basically, they're going to have big problems. No, you know, so down low, I think if I'm down low, you know, design forward. I mean, it's really the only thing I think at this point. Design forward kind of meets fashion and lifestyle, and try to go direct to consumer as much as you can. That'd be the generic, you know, and God bless you and I wish you luck solution. You know, up higher, I think there are a couple of plays. There's a product play and there's a lifestyle. And maybe they overlap to some extent. But if you think about Lange or Vacheron or Parmigiani, you know, who finally seem to have hired, I don't know whether they hired Eric Giroud or who, but you know, somebody, just a kick-ass designer, right? They finally hired someone who can really design a pretty watch. And I've owned their watch. My wife still owns a couple of watches, and they're nice. All nice movements, Vaché, blah, 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 blah. You know, you put one in a Richard Mille and sell it for 20X. You know, I think there is a product play. And within that, there's a, you know, just it's a beautiful watch play where you don't have to be a watchmaker to describe why it's a cool watch. And then there's just kind of an inherent horological merit play, you know, where you've got the long. And I think those can all work. The lifestyle play, you know, I publicly criticize some of the stuff AP has done, particularly with the launch strategy of the code, which I thought was a complete disastrous mess. You know, we just asked the hypothetical question: hey, I'm going to launch a new watch line, you know, new watch design. Great, let's launch, you know, 19. versions of 13 references all at once and market them with a campaign that talks about how smart we are about how we design.
Revolutionary. Never seen. It will shake up the world. That's right. Yeah.
Genius. But I have to say that in migrating that brand to being, you know, more of a lifestyle and fashion brand, if you're a kind of a traditionalist and, you know, you've met Mr. Mylon Sr. and all the rest, maybe you shed a tear, or maybe he still gets residuals and you know, really happy about it. I don't know, but it's a non-traditional play, but you know, the Black Panther and again, I don't vouch for it. I'm just saying, if you're going to rotate over and be kind of, you know, the second best Richard Mille, it may not be the stupidest idea, right? Sure. I mean, you know, there is a lifestyle play to be made, and it looks to some extent like that's what they're doing, you know, where they're going much more towards celebrity and influencers and obviously, you know, getting out of third-party distribution, AP House. I did an article the other day and someone wrote a comment about going to an AP House and said there was no one in there, and they asked me if I had an appointment. you know, so it's this kind of faux exclusivity thing, and are you good enough to get in here? And
Boston Boutique has only one watch usually.
Yeah, there we go. Well, you know, so I guess maybe it's working, but so I think, you know, it's an indifferent, you know, if I separate myself, my feelings from it as an AP owner and fan, it could work. Right, it could work trying to rotate that brand to pivot it over to being, you know, a lifestyle / celebrity brand. I mean, that's probably the biggest thing that's happened in the watch, you know, business in the past 10 years. Right, is it's gone from being a specialist hobby to being a mainstream luxury category with all that that who buys them, who sells them, how they're bought. how they're promoted, who's famous on Instagram, the level of knowledge that the average buyer has about the watch, it's all changed. And so I think, I mean, you look, you know, LVMH and what they're doing, I mean, the Tiffany Patek, I mean, it's kind of, again, kind of a half a page out of the same book. So, I mean, I do think there is, you know, a mainstream 2020s luxury category spin on upscale watch brands that we're going to see more. And I don't, and again, I don't think it's necessarily a stupid thing. Not for me, but, you know, I'm old anyway. One of my, you know, we're talking about, you know, Mr. Dufour and his sayings. I was talking with Max Bucer a number of years ago, and I stupidly, some, you know, minor criticism. I should have kept my mouth shut. But he said, Gary, I'm going to tell you, you're on the fringe of the fringe of the watch market as a customer. So if That's we had to depend on guys like you, we'd have gone broke years ago. I own one of his watches.
Still, even after that, wow.
I hadn't bought it yet. Yeah, no, I bought it after that. Yeah, wow. Anyway, so I think, you know, and then regardless, I think closer, for, you know, whether you're a $500 watch brand or a $50,000 watch brand, closer links to consumers, you know, communication and engagement. Again, I think Moser is an exemplar, someone who does a good job with this. I think Grubel Forsey's, you know, trying now. That's the brand, but still, you know, they're working on it. It's funny, you know, it's almost like you'd like to have. Well, it's a reorganization of what you saw with some of the watch forums and things like the Hour Lounge and the Hour Club, which was a separate Vacheron enthusiast website that eventually went bust because not enough people posted. But now, you know, on Facebook and Instagram, you know, there's the Moser owners group and there's the Lange enthusiast group. And, you know, it's kind of coming back in a way where there are openings for the brands to have those connections. And it's an enthusiast fuel, which I think is where, you know, here's my new watch. And that's really, you know, it's kind of a modern version. Self-organizing communities that could actually tap.
It's really interesting. I mean, I love hearing you sort of analyze it like that, analyze the sort of the market in the under 3,000 and over 3,000 mark. Do you think watch brands themselves are forward planning in the way that you've described? Whether, you know, do you think there's a long term plan at AP to pivot from, you know, historically dressy watches to a lifestyle consumer, or do you think they're just kind of, you know, kind of lucked into it and they're just rolling with it year quarter to quarter and go, oh, all of a sudden we've realized we're in this new corner now and we're scrambling and that's why, you know. Because I want to know is whether there is some long-term forethought, not just AP, but most brands, to go, we're here, we want to pivot towards this. Or do you think they're just kind of making it up as they go along because everything's judged every quarter and they just, everyone's chasing their tail?
You know,
prospective versus retrospective strategy.
I'm sorry?
Prospective versus retrospective strategy. Is this Mintzberg world or not?
Yeah, there we go. You know, Mintzberg was a big, big inspiration of mine, the idea of emergent strategy. But that we have a really long discussion. You could start a whole new website and podcast and we can talk about Mintzberg some other time. But I think that, well, and Clay Christensen was a big fan of emergent strategy. That I wish I were more of an insider to tell you, what's really going on. My comments about AP, you know, if I do pattern recognition on what they've been up to, the pattern in the actions is coherent enough that I suspect they may have actually intended it.
Right.
Okay. No, so I have to give credit. You know, it's not just, well, geez, you know, I made this Black Panther watch and everyone hated it, but a bunch of celebrities came and partied with me and I liked that. I mean, that could be it. But it could be that it's, you know what, Richard Mille's out there by himself and Jacob, you know, he's serving kind of the whole kind of different constituency. So that's not really, you know, so there's basically, you know, there's a gap in the market. There's an unserved space to rotate this brand into that's It's younger. It's longer lasting. It's not old guys like Gary. it's you know that basically and it's consistent with the idea of Louis Vuitton and Hermes and that there are big fashion brands and we could be one of those important fashion brands. I don't think it's out of the question. That said, if I think about most of the watch manufacturers, the brands that I know, they're product folks. Okay, they make and sell products, and so they probably have a product roadmap where it's like, okay, and I won't mention any brand in particular. We'll just say I've got Saxonia and 1815. I kid because I'm, but let's say if I'm Lange and I've got these subline franchises. I'm quite certain they've got, going out to 2030.
I'm sure.
They've got, this year it's got the Aventurine dial, and then I put the bigger crown on it, and then it's a half millimeter flatter. And then over here, Tony DeHaas, I'm going to let him invent God knows what, the turbo, whatever, whatever he wants, sure. Because he'll make six of them, we'll sell them all, and he's a genius, and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And then I've got Odysseus, and so basically you could see these product arcs, right? It's classic.
Yes.
Product planning.
IWC. Yeah, IWC is classic.
Next year at the show, it's the Portofino. Then the year after that, it's an airplane theme. Then after that, it's a race car. Then it's Top Gun. Yeah, yeah.
And we're back to Portofino again. Yeah, yeah.
And back to Portofino again. Yeah, yeah. So that's how I'm pretty sure most of these companies run. They make and sell products within product sublines. Mm. They're not thinking super hard. And then they have marketing departments who see some of this stuff and are mainly in charge of market communication. But there's probably no coherence around saying, who are we going to be in 10 years? Okay, what do we represent in 10 years? To whom, right? What is our natural market? The people who buy our products and maybe the services associated with them. What do they value? Who are they? What are they about? I think maybe Max thinks about that, but I don't think it's that common. Again, that's just my intuition based on what.
So the problem with strategy that's forward looking that the world is. We are about 2 years into deglobalization. I used to go to and fro to China. It was easy. It was a fun place to go. And that has ended. And Russia now faces that. There used to be in Boston all these tourists that would buy all sorts of stuff. And Copley Place Mall was sustained on them. No longer. Inflation's 8%. Gold's at $2,000 an ounce. And there's whispers of World War III. So how might our macro picture of global increased fragmentation impact the watchmaking? Use the old playbook.
Well, I wish I had a crystal ball.
I was going to say in 50 words or less, if you could.
In 50 words or less? Okay, here we go. Don't count them. In the enthusiast and collector market, okay, I'll subdivide it. So if you think about people who are, seriously interested in watches, in my view, it is and will remain a global community. Sure. That's not even 50 words, is it?
No, you've nailed it.
I think that's my view, and I've thought about it a bit, and I think to the extent that watches have become a mainstream fashion category and luxury category, it also tends to counter as a counterflow against the forces of fragmentation. I think when you think about the broader market, yeah, maybe there's a more of a push toward local content, local theming, buy American, buy Chinese. I don't know. What do you think? I guess I have a blind spot there, but to me, there's a certain universality about it, and then in the community of interested people, enthusiastic people, the connections that I've formed across the world. That don't depend on physically being able to go place with people in Singapore are so strong. I find it hard to imagine that goes away. I mean, What's your thought? I'm really interested to hear.
My gut is that the retail stores are going to have to stock different stuff, because in Boston, we had a lot of stores that my instinct is were not serving Bostonians.
Mm.
And so there's going to have to be a real shift meeting the needs of the local market, and will probably be some changes that have likely already started to happen. There are different trends in certain cultures that to rectangular watches, different size preferences. People travel less, perhaps global tastes become less homogenous, have to become less homogenous, catering to the average global consumer.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. Yeah, certainly at retail. Yeah.
I mean, the only thing I will add, and I will throw, you know, I will put in my ethnic hat on as somebody who came from Ukraine and Russia now. I mean, I suspect that there will be less business coming out of Russia, Swiss watches, the Swiss watch industry. And partly that will be because the trade will become harder. That's one thing. The other thing I suspect will happen is the nationalistic backlash of West versus the Russia consumer will hit, and if there's any smart Russian businessmen out there, and probably are at least one or two, they should be starting up really cool watch businesses in Russia. I mean, there's a few, you know, there's Konstantin Chaikin, and there's a few Russian makers who have historically had most of their customers in the West, so they would sell out rather than sell to. And I would imagine the longer the conflict in Ukraine goes on, the more the economic sanctions kick in, you know, there is a possibility for the domestic market of luxury watch wearers, consumers, to turn inwards and say, hey, look, why don't, instead of buying there, because the West is against us, I'll use against in terms of use, you know, there'll be some of that. And I know so there are certain brands like Ulysses Nardin, for example, who have historically relied very heavily on the Russian market. And I think those brands, particularly now, UN now has gone independent, would be a really tough spot for them.
Yeah.
So I think that will be a bit of a ripple there as well.
And likewise, it might be very hard for the Russian watchmakers to sell to Americans. And imagine.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, yeah,
and we know that.
Yeah, I think these are all great points. And I mean, you can ban me after this, but I really would like to buy another watch from because Konstantin Chaikin is a really, you know,
absolutely.
I feel for Konstantin Chaikin because he's going to have a tough time. Mm. I mean, maybe the Russian market turns inwards and maybe there's still enough money there, you know, to be buying him a watch or one of his tourbillon clocks or whatever it is. But it's got to be a real hardship on him. And he's such
absolutely.
A smart, you know.
Absolutely. Gary, fully agree. And I know of one person definitely who's ordered one of his Mars Rover watches, the new ones, and has got it on order. The watch is ready, and they can't get it out of Russia because A, you can't do the payment, and you can't do the shipping. So, the thing is, you know, we have the Fifth Wrist has a strong connection to Russian watchmakers. Konstantin Chaikin, but actually sort of a tier or two down, you know, there's like Alexander Nesterenko, there's Maxim Sushkov, right. Calibrica Designs. We've got a number of watches from those makers. Right. And we're actually trying to work on a project with one of those watchmakers now to get sort of a small series of watches. And that's where we're stuck now as well, is that we can design it, they could make it, but the payment and the shipping is a real hassle slash, at the moment, insoluble problem. So, yeah, and I think there'll be a whole sex segment of the market, you know, from watchmakers to case makers, Russian, that is, to strap makers, you know, leather goods guys, guys who make the wood, the box wood, exactly like the cottage industry in Switzerland. There is a similar cottage industry in Russia and Ukraine, for that matter. It's a real, this conflict will have issues. And there's probably similar things in Asia, in China, I would imagine. I mean, I have less connection to that market, but I'm sure they'll be the same, continue there or escalate in China, Taiwan, up China and South China.
Fair enough.
Actually, the question I want to ask you, Gary, before we move off from this thing is, you know, we talked about big brands sort of changing, pivoting strategies. The one person I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on is this changing of the legacy. We talked about Philippe Dufour, you know, we talked about Recep, young in his career, starting out. You know, we've got Kari, who is, let's say, early mid-career. He's still on the up, but expanding, you know.
we've got Philippe Dufour now is in a really interesting position where he's had most of his career was, you know, he was well respected, but probably not as well remunerated for his craft. Now he's coming towards the end of his career, and we wish him obviously a long life and many happy, productive years ahead. But, you know, he's in his 70s now. Now he's got this handing over of, you know, work to Daniela Dufour, I think is his stepdaughter, I will, related by marriage, I think. How do you think, if you were advising Philippe Dufour, and it's always, you know, dangerous place to be, how would you handle that change of legacy from an independent maker to, you know, not the name on the dial, still making it? Because that's a really interesting way to handle a delicate position.
Yeah, I'm not going to give Philippe Dufour any advice, but, if I had in my career, you know, a thousandth of the mastery that he has in his chosen work, I'd be grateful forever.
Sure. Sure.
Now, is he a marketer? No. So you're asking a marketing question. That's different.
I am. Yeah. I'm not asking how to do a Geneva Stripe. Yeah. He's got that.
Thank God. I've seen him do it. Sure. And, you know, I still don't know how.
Sure.
No, but even so, you know, I mean, I think a way to think about it is brand reach, right? You know, there's a concept of brand reach, and so which can be both kind of breadth, but also longevity. Okay, so it's like, okay, sure. I'm Kari Voutilainen, and I put my name on this Schwartz Etienne watch and a cell phone case. Was that, you know, on brand or off brand? Either one. And brands have elastic limits and you want to use them to the extent you can, but you don't want to snap it, right? You don't want that rubber band to snap. And so the question for me becomes, generationally, does the Philippe Dufour name stand for made by the man himself so much that violating that not only, you know, loses value for the future production, but also for the existing watches? Or you say, okay, look, it's a family enterprise. It's named after him. You can manage that transition deftly, and people will know whether it's, you know, whether Breguet actually made the watch himself or not, right? Mm. Was it Breguet? Was it in the workshop of Breguet? Was it after Breguet's passing, even though it says Breguet on the dock?
Sure.
People will know. So I guess, you know, in that sense, since there would be no secrets, you know, she might or might not succeed in carrying on with that watchmaking operation and with that brand. That, to me, is a separate question. It depends on, you know, the quality of the work and also on whether she's able to new design. But I think, I guess I don't see that it spells a disaster for Dufour the brand or Dufour the man or owners of current Dufour watches, myself included. You know, if she continues in his footsteps, I guess to me, and he'll tell you this, right? He's been so bad at managing people his entire career that chances are, if you own a Dufour watch, it was personally made by Dufour.
Sure.
Because he hired people and they never lasted, you know, and so you can be pretty confident that, you know, the hands, you know, touched your watch. So I guess my preference would be, you know, that it becomes Daniela Dufour, right? Even if she's making the same models of watch. That would be my preference.
You can't fire her.
I'm sorry?
You can't fire her so easily, I guess.
No, you can't. Well, I don't know. He's fired a lot of people. He's met a lot of people in his life. There are a lot of famous stories about, you know, about his. He's a demanding guy, you know.
Oh, goodness.
Sure. Sure. Absolutely.
But so I guess, you know, I don't know. I guess as a sentimental person and someone who associates the watch with the man himself so much, there's a Voutilainen watch. You know, if Venla, his daughter, takes over for him. He's already got, 20-some watchmakers in his main atelier, you know, not even counting Compliment. You know, Kari, you know, if I get a watch from him, maybe he'll do a little of it himself because, you know, it's a sentimental thing or he's, you know, yep. wants to, you know, or not. I don't know. Maybe he doesn't want to touch the watch that comes out. Who knows? Maybe, you know, he licks the back of it before he puts it together. But anyway, there it's more kind of the studio of.
Sure. Yes, exactly.
Well, it's like, you know, Anita Porsche, someone who would know told me that if on the dial it says Anita Porsche, she did it. If it says A Porsche, it's done in her atelier, but not necessarily by her.
Oh, that's interesting. That's good. That's good knowledge. I mean, both are fantastic and the quality might be exactly the same, but yeah, but that's an important distinction. No, that's
and to me. No, sorry, to me, a Philippe Dufour watch, chances are it's done by Philippe Dufour. Hence, you know, it would be like Anita Porsche.
Yeah.
This is like Damien Hirst's dots. So he once told someone that if he made the dots himself, they wouldn't be quite as good as if his studio made them. The other people make them better.
Yeah. No, I mean, and the reason, you know, we're being a bit facetious. And the only reason I'm asking about the Philippe Dufour, Daniela Dufour transition, I am really fascinated about the legacy, you know, the transfer of legacy for these particularly small independents, you know, because we hear about, oh, what happens if Vianney Poulter passes away or all that kind of stuff. And there's all this argument about, should you carry the brand or does the brand stop? And I just think with Daniela, I mean, I wish her nothing but the best, same as for Philippe. I'm a big fan of both. And I think what she's doing is fantastic and very brave, but she's in a bit of a pickle because even if her watches are technically better than Philippe's at some point, there will still be this debate of, oh, you know, but it's not as like when the old man was still hacking away at it. So she's in this impossible circle. And in my mind, it's a little bit like, you know, the passing of George Daniels and the Roger Smith taking over. You know, Roger worked with Daniels, but when Roger went off and did his own thing, he started a Roger Smith watch company. He didn't just say, no, it's a Daniels watch company, but made by Roger Smith. And I always find that sort of fascinating, that the tension between the legacy.
You know, there's a famous, I collect among other things, Native American jewelry. And there's a famous, the most famous Native American jeweler is a guy named Charles Loloma. Okay. And Loloma made these very recognizable lapidary works. I mean, they're just gorgeous, and you wouldn't necessarily think, you know, Native American. I mean, they're just it's really interesting work. Okay. And his niece Verma worked with him in his workshop, and probably a lot of the pieces that were made in the later years she actually made. Okay,
sure.
Then he passed away. And she kept making things, but she makes them under her own trade name, which is Sanwai. But it's the same thing. It's like Roger Smith, right? It's okay if you get, and I own both, right? So if you own a Sanwai, it's unbelievably great. But it doesn't have the value of something that's signed by Loloma, even if Sanwai made it. Sure. So there is this kind of weird thing, you know?
Yeah. The signature carries, it's not always about the quality of the product. It's about the name. No, absolutely. So,
and, same thing in conceptual art.
Yeah, well, it's the same with classic art as well. I mean, you know, Peter Paul Rubens had a big studio and he, you know, he was a very successful artist in his Renaissance period. You know, he would sign all the paintings and he might do some of the finer details, but the majority of it was painted in by assistants and sort of production line, 500 years ago. So it's not a new...
Say, could I violate all rules of conduct and ask to go back to a prior topic briefly?
Please.
Well, I've been thinking about this thing about deglobalization and darker times, which I hope don't persist. I think we all do. But the thing that comes to mind, I saw the one of the greatest talks was by Fabrizio Buonamassa, the design chief at Bulgari, he was asked, why is it that vintage and sort of vintage revival is so big these days? And he said, in design in the 1950s, people believed that the future would be better than the past. And therefore, design was future. And you had Streamliners and Raymond Loewy and the Studebaker and Lockheed Electra, dramatic constellation, and all these things. That, and now many people believe that the future will be worse than the past. And so there's this longing for a better time in the past that may not actually have existed.
And so
if we take that and we push it one level further, you say, well, what if people believe that the future is like borderline apocalyptic? Then design could become very dark, even into the world of watches, where things could become much more minimalistic. Or you can go the opposite. Watches become an escape, the troubles of the world. And all of a sudden, there's this explosion of very florid pieces. I just think it'll be interesting to see, because I thought his argument was really compelling. Sort of the prevailing mood and how it reflected itself in design at the time. I think, again, I'll reveal my age and lack of musical taste, but it's sort of like the past 5 years, most popular music seems to consist of someone mumbling about why they're depressed. And as opposed to like belting out about how, I'm going to go get laid or something. Okay, fine. It's a reflection of the times we live in. I just think that design will likely continue to react to the general sense of the time.
There's so many directions we can go with this. Just the music comment. I mean, we won't, but it's a fascinating sociological discussion because you could chart that pop music with trends in all sorts of behavior of young people, from drinking to a number of sexual encounters and everything. That's a whole other thing. But that is a very interesting. I mean, that is a very genuinely interesting thing about the mood. The zeitgeist determines design language going forward. Yeah, whether it's retrospective or prospective. Really interesting.
I found him a very impressive guy, and I think his work is great.
So you've served on the GPHG jury. What's the experience like? And more importantly, what did you learn from it?
It's a fascinating experience. You sit in the room. At the time, there were 30 jurors, and you're divided into three tables of 10 people at any given point. Then they bring three trays into the room, three different categories of six watches. They set one down on each table, and you talk about them at your table, and then you fill out your prioritization sheets. And then they rotate, and then once you've done three categories, they take all those away. Half the people get up and switch tables, and half the people stay. Right? So through the day, you're constantly cross-fertilizing, and you're not having a free-for-all where 30 people are shouting over it. Then at the end of the day, you do have a free-for-all in which you talk about the big awards, right? The award and the revelation and the Guy d'Or and the above category prizes. And it's a great mix of people, and so when I was on it both years, Mr. Dufour was on the jury. You have someone like Mr. Siddiqui, Mike Tay, Suzanne Wong, Arl Box was the president of the jury both of those years, Jassem Alzarai, Patekaholic, was on the jury 1 year, Aldous Hodge, people who know watches and bring different perspectives. So that was actually very interesting. I have to say that the level of preparation and in-depth knowledge was somewhat uneven. So because I'm obsessive and like being well prepared, I had pages and pages of notes and.
Sure. You approach it with scientific rigor. Let's go with that.
Well, I don't know how scientific, but certainly rigor. Had. Done kind of my own straw poll in each category beforehand going into the room, and then and spent not an insignificant amount of time explaining to some other people about no, this actually, like, this thing flies back and that's how it works, and that kind of thing. Just to make sure that each piece had its merits fully illuminated, so people have. But so, you know, some people took it more seriously than others. In the room, people were, you know, always present, always engaged. And I think people, by and large, played it pretty straight. And again, I know I signed some vow that I'm not allowed to talk about anything happened in the room, so I'm speaking to some extent.
Well, no, that's fine.
But you know, I was a new member, sort of the first year. But if I said something that made any sense at all, people would listen and think incorporate it into their feelings. And I listened carefully to what they said. And I learned things about how people think about watches, you know, even pieces that are put forward very much on their technical merits, that, you know, appearance matters, and pieces that are beautiful jeweled pieces. Well, if it's a crap watch, that's no good. You know, I mean, so this, the whole idea of being a complete piece you know, the thing that to be a truly great watch, everything has to fit, right? There has to be a coherence and integrality about it. It's a very Swiss discussion, even though there are some international jurors. You know, it's called the Grand Prix de Genève for a reason. It's not the Grand Prix of Vienna or New York or Moscow. So, you know, you do get that, both in terms of, you know, how people view the brands, and also I think in terms of the discussion, and certain things are kind of said but left unsaid. And, you know, I mean, my knowledge of Swiss culture gets better all the time, but it's, you know, it's got its own rules of engagement. Once in a while you'd get a comment about, well, you know, so-and-so brand hasn't won in a while, and wouldn't it be great? But then that would usually, I'd kind of expected, which was people were, you know, homers for a certain brand or another. I had a little bit of that, but I, with 30 people, it's hard to overwhelm 30 people, especially, you know, like William Messina and Jack Ford.
Yes, strong voices.
Exactly. Strong voices, strong opinions of people who are not going to be dictated to. And then, you know, the big discussions at the end of the day, I thought were, you know, again, interesting. And it was, I thought, reached suitable conclusions. You know, I couldn't really, having been in the discussion, I couldn't look at it and say, you know, I absolutely think we, you know, made a stinker of a decision, or I can't believe that these morons outvoted me. I'm sorry.
Well, you're not allowed to say that, obviously, because you've signed an NDA. But other, we're reading that between.
I thought the work of the group was pretty good, quite solid, and then the discussion about the jury prizes. You know, the 1 year we Luke Pedovino.
And
I was a big advocate.
Oh, that was great. That was wonderful.
And but against virtually no resistance. It wasn't like I was on the battlements and people were saying no, it must be, you know, Joe Schmutzberg. No, it was like, as soon as his name came out, I was like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And that was was just lovely. And then Bivere the prior year. I mean, how can you? You know, other names were discussed, but not at great length.
The one question I had about the juries, the people who are sitting on the jury, is the process imbued with this is really important, or is the process imbued more like, well, this is a thing that happens, you know, it's a bit of fun, let's, you know, is it approached with kind of the pomp and ceremony from within? Or whether it's more like, well, it's a fun thing, you know, let's discuss it, but it's not, you know, let's not kill each other over
it. I think the discussion was quite serious. The discussion was rarely very heated. It was quite civil, but people had strong views. But people did change their mind. I changed my mind, you know, a number of times based on the discussion. People took it serious, and you could hear a pin drop, you know, when they bring the new tray. And people would be passing them around and holding the loop and everything. There was no screwing around. People were looking at their phones.
So that's good. That's good. So it's approached with, you know, deliberation and thought behind it. So that's really good. That's wonderful.
No, absolutely. And I think, again, there are people who sat on the jury before they completely reconstituted it this past time, you know, for many years. But I think they viewed themselves to some extent, you know, as guardians of continuity and were very serious. Sure. And then the newcomers, it's like, geez, how the hell did I get here? You know, the 30 people in the world who get to say what the best watches of the year are, how the hell did I get in here? So you bet, you know, I took it seriously. It was, you know, holy shit, I'm on the jury of the Grand Prix. How could
Oh, well, that's good.
You know, it's a big honor.
Oh, that's good. No, absolutely. So okay, well, that's really reassuring. That's great to hear, you know, that it's not just a popularity contest, nor is it just a bit of flippery. Yeah, no, that's good.
No, well, in this past year, you know, I know a bunch of the jurors and, you know, talked to you know, Dusick, Lou, who was from New York, and I actually nominated him for the Academy. And then I think he got picked out of the hat to be a jury member. And you know, he was so excited and grateful. And, you know, and Julie Crawless, you know, the illustrator, I talked with her afterwards, and she said it was the experience of a lifetime. And, people took it serious.
Beautiful.
So looking forward, how do you see your collection evolving?
Gradually getting smaller. Everything has a life cycle, right? It starts, it shoots up, it plateaus, and then it gradually declines. No. You know, I am bringing some pieces in. What that means is some pieces are going out, so, you know, gone out. Still very active patronage of a commission piece coming, I hope, within the next 12 to 18 months. and a second piece that's promised. Yeah. Second piece that is, you know, could come pretty soon or could be anytime in the next 3 years. So those are kind of, you know, and then the question becomes, when do they come? When are the payments due? And therefore, when do I have to decide to sell something? But I'm pretty happy. I've got really nice, I mean, the vintage pieces that I like. You know, the 1526 Patek, you know, the first ever serially produced perpetual calendar wristwatch. It's a very special piece to me. And it's weird because it's not super popular. But to me, history is on my side. And it's a really important piece. And I just love the way it looks. And the dial on mine is so good that you know, it's just a joy to wear. So, I mean, that's the thing, you know, I don't want to seem too weird about it, but as long as the things bring me joy, I'm going to keep them. You know, I stashed away a few bucks over the years, so I'm starving and willing. But, you know, eventually I'll taper it down and some of the pieces are going to find really good, happy homes. I think, you know, I feel it's important to continue buying from, so I'm going to.
Hear. That's great. Absolutely. Well, I mean, I know we are winding down but you know, we'll have to bring you back at some point, Gary. You're a fountain of knowledge. There's so many things we didn't even get to talk about, you know, photography, all sorts of stuff that we'll have to bring you back for another session sometime in the future. But no, that sounds, so many to talk about. As we usually, what we do as we start to wind down, one thing we do towards the end of these sort of episodes is we ask ourselves and our guests for recommendations to really expand both our knowledge and our listeners' knowledge. And it can be, you know, Instagram accounts to follow, books or whatever cultural touch points that you think worth others knowing about as well. I might throw it to Adam first, actually, while you're thinking.
Sure.
I'd like to put him on the spot.
So I am going to recommend Interior Angles on Instagram.
Yes.
He is a collector that ironically also has a 5050G as well as a lot of other pieces. And really is an appreciation for high horology. And so I think that there's something to experience by looking at this collection, and he's been very helpful in my collecting journey. Interior.angles.
Oh, it's an amazing collection of all sort of watches, Indie watches. That's great.
Yeah, if you could see the piece of paper that I've written on, look, interior.angles right there on the piece of paper.
Yeah. It's like a magic trick. We throw the same person.
I have a longer list, but I'm really happy to hear that. So,
Gary, we'll throw it to you.
Go ahead.
All right. I'll go. I'll also do an Instagram recommendation. And it's a really cool account that I really like. It's @Arontius_Phineas. or so it's O-R-O-N-U-S underscore F-I Orontius Phineas. Now, I'd imagine it's not the original Orontius Phineas. Now, original Orontius Phineas was an astronomer and a cartographer who died around 1530 or so. So I'm guessing it's not that Orontius Phineas. Look, really cool account, really spectacular sort of collection, really thoughtful commentary. And recently I've interacted with the person about somebody we talked about on this episode, Parmigiani Fleurier, which actually talked about some of the earlier watch that I the Ionica, which first in a Punhouse movement back in 98, I think. So no, really cool account, really cool follow. Orontius underscore.
Insane. Phineas. Yeah.
All right, Gary, we'll throw it over to you. I've got a pen hovering over my note paper here.
I don't know. You know, it is interior angles, interior dot angles. Also is a close personal friend of mine. That's good.
There you go. See? Wonderful.
And a member of our Northern California watch gang, as it turns out. So one of the nicest human beings. I tell you, everyone has flaws. His flaw is too nice. It's his own, his only flaw. I'm telling you.
Yeah.
Okay, so if I may have two. One, if you don't know watchmaker Christian Lass.
Friend of the show. Yeah, previous guest. He's been on twice, actually. Yeah, Christian's been on a guest twice.
Yeah, so legend. For folks who may not know him and his wife, Hannelore, we met him when he was working at Patek. And then he was at the New York or the Singapore Exposition explaining one of the complications. They hired him kind of just to show up and be bright. And he mentioned he was making a watch, and one thing led to another. So, but I think he's a super guy and a great talent. And then I've made a list of Instagram accounts, but I'll pick one. L951.1 for the Lange movement. He is a longtime collector, good personal friend of mine, an astounding collection. He may have the greatest vintage Minerva collection.
Cool.
Which he inherited from his godfather, who was, among other things, a long enthusiast, but also a patron of my friend L951.1, has carried that on. He goes to all the auctions. You know, he has all these great kind of obscure wrist shots of auction watches that you probably wouldn't have looked at. And, you know, a few words about why they're interesting and just a nice change of pace. And then a fair amount of longer related, but it's not a long pay.
Cool. No, that's a great account. I wasn't following you before. That's fantastic.
Definitely.
Very, very cool. Oh, thank you. Look, Gary, it's been an honor, but it's been a huge pleasure to have this conversation with you. I said there's a whole,
so fortunate,
you know, reams of questions being put through. We will have to get you back sometime to lay down some more wisdom, but I just wanted to thank you for joining us and sharing your passion, your story, and your knowledge. So it's been, yeah, great. Have you on.
A thrill for me. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, Gary.
And the last thing we always say is, you know, with the episode, with Thrift, we set it up as a platform by enthusiasts and for enthusiasts. So if you want to join us, contribute, write reviews, or come on the show, please get in touch. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram or on our website at fifth.com. Follow me. I'm at Times Roman AU. My valiant co-host is at Medium Watch. And of course, our fantastic guest, the incomparable Mr. Gary G, is at Gary G underscore one. Also on Quill and Pad, where you must read his writing. Thanks for joining us today, and stay on time.
Fifth Wrist is by the community for the community. We would love you to join the crew via our group chat on Slack. Email us at contact@fifthwrist.com and join the movement.